and political, because we're not even supposed to be here. That's definitely the messaging and strategy that I use.
Ali, we have less than a minute left, but I'm wondering just if you could quickly say what your main expectations are of the new Biden administration's policy toward the Native American people.
Yeah, well, we're definitely going to be making sure that we're represented, especially when it comes to climate change. We do want a seat at the table. We want to be in that conversation because we have just incredible knowledge about how the ways that we respect Mother Earth, that we honor Mother Earth, and those are things that will end up saving Mother Earth. And so learning from us and collaborating with us, and also on issues of, we're still in COVID-19 and it's still severely impacting our tribal communities. So we're expecting them to work with us and helping us to bring the funding and the aid that we need, because $8 billion was not enough in the initial stimulus package.
We want to thank you so much, Ali Young, for being with us. Citizen of the Navajo Nation, organized throughout Arizona, is in New Mexico now, and founder of Protect the Sacred. And we will bring you Burton Warrington, Menominee, Potawatomi, and Ho-Chunk at democracynow.org to talk about the critical Native voter count in Wisconsin. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's freeze goes into effect today, mostly impacting restaurants and bars around the state. Meanwhile, Clackamas County Commissioner Tootie Smith went on Fox News to advocate for a full Thanksgiving and good news for the United States as multiple COVID vaccines continue through their certification process. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Oregonians are beginning a second wave of lockdown orders Wednesday following mandates issued by Kate Brown last Friday. The lockdown comes at a critical time, as today the United States hit the unfortunate and devastating milestone of 250,000, a quarter million dead from COVID-19. In Oregon today, 1,099 new cases were reported, and over 400 people are currently hospitalized with the virus, a new record for the state. Brown's freeze orders will last statewide for a minimum of 2 weeks, while hotspot areas such as Multnomah County will carry the orders for at least 4 weeks in efforts to flatten the curve of new coronavirus cases. Brown's freeze orders halt dine-in service at bars and restaurants, limit social gatherings to 6 or less, shut down all state theaters, entertainment venues, museums, and gyms, and put capacity restrictions on retailers. All businesses were told to implement work-from-home protocols when at all possible, These measures hold an executive order, making them enforceable by law, with spokespeople from Brown's office saying, quote, "We are working with law enforcement," and that they will attempt a, quote, "educate first approach before issuing violations." Oregon State Police released a statement on Thursday echoing similar sentiments, saying they will issue criminal citations only as a last resort, and urge citizens to uphold the governor's orders, reminding us, quote, "We are all in this together." For people or businesses found in noncompliance, if a violation is cited criminally, it is considered a Class C misdemeanor and could result in 30 days in jail and a fine of over $1,000 or both. Currently, the freeze does not change the current health and safety protocols for personal services such as barbershops, salons, and non-medical massage therapy. Brown's orders come at a time when nationwide spikes in COVID-19 are surging, including in Oregon, and concerns loom over hospitals reaching capacity and becoming overwhelmed with those requiring hospitalization. An Oregon county commissioner is challenging Governor Kate Brown's new coronavirus restrictions, posting on social media that she is planning a large holiday get-together despite Brown's freeze orders. Clackamas County Chair-elect Tootie Smith posted this week on her Facebook page, quote, "My family will celebrate Thanksgiving with as many family and friends I can find. Governor Brown is wrong to order otherwise," end quote. Smith's post had led to media attention, with NBC's Today Show featuring a story surrounding it, and Smith speaking with Fox News about what she is calling Brown's hypocrisy. Following the governor's directives that her office be working with local law enforcement to uphold the freeze orders, Smith told Fox's Tucker Carlson that attempts to enforce these restrictions are, quote, "a travesty." She also said, quote, "How dare Governor Brown think she's going to send police into people's homes and have them arrested for having a Thanksgiving meal with family while rioters and anarchists are allowed to destroy downtown in the city of Portland? That's hypocrisy," end quote. Smith's controversial statements also likened the governor's order to slavery. Brown has stated that though her freeze orders are enforceable by law, she is urging an education first attempt in lieu of fining individuals rather than criminally citing them. In her Tuesday address, Brown stated, quote, "When Oregonians don't take COVID-19 seriously and don't take steps to reduce the spread of the disease, they put us all at risk," end quote. Most fellow lawmakers do not share Smith's perspective and are choosing to comply with Brown's executive orders in hopes of flattening the infection curve. Commissioner Sonia Fisher rebuked Smith's plan to defy and gather, saying, quote, "Sending a message of having large gatherings is very, very dangerous. We know the science of this virus is that it spreads through social gatherings. That is where the spread is happening," end quote. Similarly, many commenters on Smith's initial Facebook post warned that her resistance could be dangerous, with several posting responses urging Smith to, quote, "listen to science" and not, quote, "be a part of the problem." Governor Brown's freeze orders will remain in place statewide through December 2nd, with hotspot counties such as Multnomah's orders lasting through December 16th. The first full report from late-stage testing reveals Pfizer's COVID vaccine is 95% effective while causing no serious side effects. The vaccine performed surprisingly well among older adults, a population hit particularly hard by the severe symptoms of COVID-19. Older adults do not always respond well to certain vaccines, but trials found the Pfizer vaccine 94% effective in adults over the age of 65. This news comes a week after the company initially reported the vaccine's efficacy at 90%. Pfizer collaborated with German biotech company BioNTech to develop the vaccine at a record speed. The companies plan to apply to the FDA for emergency authorization within the next few days. If authorized, Pfizer says they will be able to provide up to 50 million doses by the end of the year and up to 1.3 billion by the end of 2021. The federal government will provide the vaccine to Americans free of charge, but only half of Pfizer's supply will go to the U.S. next year, enough for 12.5 million Americans. Earlier this week, Moderna also announced its COVID vaccine is 94.5% effective. Moderna says it can provide about 20 million doses by the end of the year, enough for 10 million Americans. Healthcare workers and the most vulnerable population, such as older Americans, will receive vaccines first. Health officials are optimistic about both vaccines, though they urge people not to let their guard down, as it will take time to develop enough doses for all Americans. They encourage the public to keep following guidelines for hand washing, masks, and social distancing. As the holiday season approaches and the 2020 pandemic year comes to an end, so will important economic support for American workers who are unemployed or partially employed. The Bipartisan CARES Act was signed into law on March 27th. It expanded unemployment benefits in two key ways to serve the American people in a time of economic hardship. One was an expansion of unemployment aid to include self-employed and partially employed workers who previously did not qualify for unemployment insurance. The second was an extension of the total number of weeks an individual could receive assistance from 26 weeks to 39 weeks. This provided 13 additional weeks of economic support to struggling workers, but both of these expanded benefits will end on December 31st of this year. For months, Congress has remained in a stalemate over the new coronavirus relief bill. The question is not if there should be a new bill, rather how much that bill should cost and where the funds should go. Democrats want a second $2 trillion bill, equal to the amount of the original CARES Act, that will support schools, small businesses, state and local governments, and unemployment insurance. Republicans want a much smaller $500 billion bill that Mitch McConnell has said would be, quote, narrowly targeted at schools, at healthcare providers, at PPP, and of course, liability reform. Plans from both parties would provide new economic assistance to Americans, but at notably different levels. The proposed plan from Democrats would issue a second $1,200 stimulus check to individuals, as well as reinstate the $600 per week supplemental jobless benefit. The proposed plan from Republicans would not include a second stimulus check, but would initiate a $300 per week enhanced jobless benefit. Although coronavirus rates are spiking across the United States and cities are initiating new shutdown measures, both parties have not shown promising movement toward a compromise. In his first speech on the economy as president-elect on Monday, Joe Biden urged Congress to approve a new relief bill before he takes office and showed his support for a plan like the one Democrats are backing. On the subject of a relief bill, President Donald Trump tweeted on November 14th, quote, Congress must now do a COVID relief bill. Need Democrats' support. Make it big and focused. Get it done! Exclamation point. Without offering clear direction or guidance, it's unlikely that Trump's communication will invigorate a deadlocked Congress to push forward a new relief bill before December. The states of Oregon and California are lending help to keep Klamath Dam's demolition on track. Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service has more on the story.
Oregon and California are stepping up to save a project to remove dams from the Klamath River. The states are applying to co-license removal alongside tribes, the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, and dam owner PacifiCorps. In July, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission decided PacifiCorps should be liable for removal of four dams on the Klamath. The utility has disagreed. In this new agreement, the states would share liability with the company. Brian Graber with the group American Rivers says the removal project is important to restoring species like salmon in the region.
The Klamath River was once the third largest salmon-producing river on the West Coast, and these dams and their impacts have really destroyed that salmon fishery.
One of the dams is in Oregon and three are in California. Removing them will restore 400 stream miles of the Klamath. PacifiCorps agreed to remove the dams in 2010. The dam's threats to fish have had a big impact on the Yurok tribe. Frankie Myers with the tribe says the health of his people and the land are intertwined, making river restoration key to restoring the Yurok people's society and culture. He cites one Yurok story that says if there's ever a time when the river doesn't have salmon, there will be no need for the Yurok people.
So that's what it means to us as Yurok people. The survival of the salmon is the survival of our culture and our people here on Earth.
Graber notes about 1,700 dams have been removed across the United States to the benefit of local ecosystems.
There's really no faster or effective way to bring a river back to life than taking a dam out.
He says removal is estimated to cost $450 million and could begin in 2023. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Is it possible that a new law will make it illegal for police to enforce other more established laws? Yes, and that actually happened in Northwest Oregon's Columbia County, as well as in Eastern Oregon's Umatilla County, where voters recently approved measures directing county workers, police included, to ignore the state's extreme risk protection law, the concealed carry law, and most other state gun regulations. Officers who enforce those laws risk prosecution and hefty fines. The Extreme Risk Protection Law was passed in 2017. It allows judges to remove guns from people not convicted of a crime but whose behavior indicates they might shoot themselves or someone else. The new law will now make that illegal. Rob Taylor is an Oregon guns rights activist. He has lobbied for such measures across the state and said, quote, "All we were doing was trying to get rid of all these regulations that we believe are designed to eliminate gun ownership." Court challenges are expected to these, quote, gun sanctuary ordinances, in part because under Oregon law, only the legislature has the power to regulate almost all aspects of firearms. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the dire COVID-19 situation in Oregon prisons, which have reported a record number of deaths from the virus. Then, stay tuned at 5:45 for news from the BOO, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be light rain with a low of 44. Tomorrow's weather, we can expect showers and a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1948, Cuban-American performance artist Ana Mendieta was born. Much of her work focused on the relationship between the female body and nature. She died at the age of 36 when she fell 33 stories from her apartment in Greenwich Village. The quote of the day is from Mendieta, who said, quote, "My art is the way I reestablish the bonds that tie me to the universe." The Northern Cheyenne tribe made history this month when they swore in several female leaders. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Northern Cheyenne tribe in southeast Montana inaugurated its newly elected officials Tuesday, which includes a record number of female leaders. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports from Lame Deer.
The Northern Cheyenne tribe made history this month when tribal members elected all women to the positions of tribal president, vice president, and into each of the five open seats on the tribal council. After prayers and speeches, each woman was sworn into office while hundreds watched from socially distanced chairs, cars in the parking lot, and online.
And I will promote
and protect
the best interests
of the Northern Cheyenne tribe.
Donna Fisher, the new president of Northern Cheyenne, says she's anxious to get to work.
We as women, we will work together to get things. We won't always be on the same page, but we will work together to get things done. And this is what the people have voted us in there for.
There are now 7 women serving on the 10-seat council. I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
Leaders of the Yurok and Karuk tribes, the states of California and Oregon, and a dam owner announced an agreement Tuesday to provide additional resources and support to advance salmon restoration. The project addresses declines in fish populations and improves river health. The agreement with the tribe states, PacifiCorps, and the Klamath River Renewal Corporation describes how the parties will implement a 2016 agreement, which sets terms for the removal of 4 dams on the Klamath River. Karuk Chairman Buster Atterbury.
I'm looking forward very much to having the best day as chairman of the Karuk tribe when I can say that we have restored those fish and that we can enjoy those bonding times with our children when we can go to the river and we can put food on a table together.
Plans include navigating the final regulatory approvals to allow the project to begin in 2022 with dam removal in 2023. Federal approval is still needed. The Rapid City Council has approved a resolution to resolve a land dispute over more than 1,000 acres on the west side of the city, an old Indian boarding school. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Richard Tubles reports.
The council approved the historic resolution with a 9-1 vote. It's a step to rectify history and acknowledge the shameful legacy of the Rapid City Indian Boarding School. There was very little public comment on Monday's council meeting. One person did not support the resolution, saying it wasn't clear who represents the Native community in this effort. Troy Fairbanks, on the other hand, agreed that the city council should approve the resolution on principle alone.
I want to commend you, each and every one of you, for actually taking a look at what is right through city council. The only ones that have ever stood up for us, even thought about talking about the Native Indian community. That is tremendous.
An initial vote on the resolution was tabled 2 weeks ago. Council members had doubts and questions about it. Before their vote on Monday, City Attorney Joel Landine said the resolution creates a path to resolve the underlying issues.
This is not legally binding. It is an intent to come up with, hopefully, an agreement that when we enter into it will be legally binding. It outlines the parameters broadly, but yeah, we will need to come back with a specific plan.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs, which operates under the Department of Interior, has the final decision on these parcels of land. The BIA wants the Rapid City Native American community to work with the city to move forward. I'm Richard Tubles.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In his continuing attempts to stay in office, President Trump has one less straw to clutch, the state of Michigan. Two Republican election certifiers in Wayne County, which is the home of Detroit, reversed their earlier position and joined the two Democratic certifiers to declare Joe Biden the winner there. The two Republicans drew strong criticisms and accusations of racism for their early refusal to certify the election. Detroit is 80% Black and African American. In other election news, Trump fired Christopher Krebs, the director of the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Krebs had repeatedly confirmed the integrity of the election, refuting the president's claim of widespread voter fraud. On November 12th, Krebs wrote, quote, "The November 3rd election was the most secure in American history." In his statement firing Krebs last night, Trump said he took the action because Krebs had made, quote, "highly inaccurate statements about the election." President Trump continues to block President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris from attending briefings, yet he remains active in firing security officials. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Biden has won this election. He's taking office on January 20th. Trump is a lame-duck president, and they're still processing lifetime judicial nominees. They'll sit on the court literally for life, having an impact on all of Americans' lives. And they're not doing COVID relief.
Marge Baker with People for the American Way says it's a mistake for the Republican-led Senate to prioritize appointing more federal judges over the nation's immediate needs. After blocking Obama's judicial appointments for years, Republicans have confirmed hundreds of their own. Baker says there's a pattern to the nominees, young and ultra-conservative.
They'll have lifetime seats on the court, well beyond Trump being in office, well beyond McConnell being in office.
Yesterday, the Senate confirmed Benjamin Beaton in Kentucky, another member of the ultra-conservative legal group, the Federalist Society. Besides fighting the results of the election, the Trump administration is hard at work in other areas. After rolling back more than 125 Obama-era environmental protections, 40 more are in the works. The administration is also rushing to auction off land in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas companies. They fear the Biden administration would block it. Since the election, the president's also been firing more top national security and Pentagon officials, most recently Chris Krebs, the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Before being terminated via Twitter yesterday, Krebs said every claim of alleged voter fraud has been, quote, unsubstantiated or technically incoherent. Days after dismissing Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Trump also replaced the Pentagon's top policy official, James Anderson, with a former Fox News contributor.
Over the past week, President Trump has upended any sense of stability in the Department of Defense. He literally wants to attack Iran and has plans to weaken our military, betray our allies, and arm our enemies.
Veteran and Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth says the president is endangering domestic and national security by, quote, forcing the Pentagon into his latest culture war. Duckworth lost both legs serving in Iraq after 9/11.
This upheaval represents a dangerous escalation at one of the most fraught moments possible. Let me just give you a little historical reference here. Our enemies historically have tested us within the first year of each new administration.
Biden and Harris are still blocked from classified intelligence. On the U.S. Senate floor yesterday, several Republicans appeared to congratulate Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott, both of South Carolina, and Mike Rounds of South Dakota, among others. After Georgia's Republican Secretary of State revealed that Graham had pressured him to throw out legally cast absentee ballots, Graham told reporters he had discussed concerns with officials in Nevada and Arizona as well, though both states' top election officials denied having spoken with Graham. In Michigan, Wayne County Board of Canvassers, the state's largest county and home to Detroit, temporarily blocked certifying their votes until the two Republican members finally agreed. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service and produced for television by Free Speech TV, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
The American Heart Association is planning to tackle systemic racial health disparities in the United States. Diane Bernard has more on the story.
Spurred on by racial imbalances in COVID-19 deaths and a national reckoning on race, the American Heart Association has put out a call to action for health groups to tackle the structural racism that leads to major health disparities. The group says institutional discrimination in the U.S. contributes to higher rates of cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, and type 2 diabetes in Black and brown communities. AHA President Dr. Mitchell Elkin says knowledge of these health gaps isn't new, but his group sees a greater sense of urgency to address them.
The association will leverage our scientific enterprise, education, and advocacy work to support national awareness of structural racism and to promote a national reconciliation. The people of these communities deserve nothing less, and society must demand it.
He says the group is committing millions of dollars to scientific research on diseases that hit underrepresented communities. Funding will also go toward new local, state, and federal efforts to provide equitable access to health care and healthy food. Elkin says health care accessibility among races is uneven, and even with the Affordable Care Act, which is being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court, he says Black and brown people are still more likely to be uninsured than whites. Gaps in heart disease rates also are pronounced.
Black Americans continue to experience a nearly 30% higher death rate from cardiovascular disease and a 45% higher death rate from stroke compared with non-Hispanic white Americans.
According to CDC data, heart disease is the leading cause of death for African Americans. In Virginia, deaths from heart ailments are about 1.3 times more common for blacks than whites. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is hunkering down for the holidays.
Stores, bars, and restaurants were real busy last couple days, folks getting some comfort and out-of-home experience before today's new restrictions kicked in, which few believe will last just 2 weeks. Will the false right-wing scare of the government canceling Christmas finally come true? How many, like Tootie Smith in Clackamas County, will be giving thanks that they don't believe in science? Seems like we're headed toward crowd Darwinism, not crowd immunity. Good news about coronavirus vaccines, but nothing in the works to cure racism, corporate greed, or environmental destruction. 45 years ago, Gil Scott Heron sang, "It's winter in America, now it's the winter of America." Trump won't leave the White House. McConnell will continue to block even the possibility of hope, while Biden's lack of courage in standing up to Trump and the Democratic Party's attack on their own progressives show that while a glaring symptom of our pandemics may be removed, the deeper causes are well protected by the powerful and their minions. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
At least 6 people have been killed and more than 400,000 affected after Hurricane Iota struck Nicaragua. 99.5% of properties on the Nicaraguan Caribbean coast were without electricity. Iota is headed west, towards Honduras and El Salvador. 2 weeks ago, Hurricane Eta made landfall 15 miles from where Iota has and affected over 3.6 million people in Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala. This year's Atlantic hurricane season, which usually runs from June to November, is the most active in history, with 30 named storms and 13 hurricanes in the 6-month period. President-elect Joe Biden tweeted last night, quote, "I'm keeping in my prayers all of our friends and neighbors in Hurricane Iota's path and those impacted by Hurricane Eta all across Central America." You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Henrik Brokelschen, Samantha Law, Dan Raphael, Karen James, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Diane Bernard, Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tagadoff. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
With cases of COVID-19 raging across the nation, there is concern about the prisoners in lockdown in Oregon prisons. With me is Ray Fox, who was formerly incarcerated in the Oregon prison system. Ray, talk about what it's like in the Oregon prisons, especially when we talk about social distancing. How do the men live? Do they have single cells?
Single cells in the Department of Corrections are pretty much not happening. There's very few single cells. The Disciplinary Segregation Unit has single cells. IMU's got single cells, which is the Intensive Management Unit. So you're bunked in a cell at the Oregon State Penitentiary, OSCI, all of them. So anywhere you live, you're going to have somebody in your cell where there's no social distancing at all. A lot of the prisons got dormitories where there's no way you can social distance there either.
So are they social distancing in the chow hall?
They all go to the dining room, and you got a dining room that holds, depending on what prison you're in, it could hold up to maybe 75 to 100 people. And the tables are really close together with barely walking room in between the tables. What they were doing as far as social distancing in the chow hall were, and I say were because that's what I've been told, is they were just running one housing unit at a time to the chow hall. That's all great, but if you got infected people, you're still going to infect the guys because they got to take their masks off to eat their meals.
And Ray, you have friends inside who you have been communicating with. What are they telling you?
I have a friend that's at the Oregon State Correctional Institution whose cellie tested positive for COVID-19. 3 days after his cellie tested positive for COVID-19, they moved his cellie to Coffee Creek Correctional Institution, is where they're putting people that get tested positive for COVID for 2 weeks. So then they started testing my friend every day for COVID. He tested positive eventually. They moved him to Coffee Creek. The guy's 67 years old. He's got a firm release date of February of next year. He's been in close to 40 years. His parents are old. He's just trying to get out to see his parents before they die.
So he has 3 months left on his 40-year prison sentence, and instead of releasing him, they send him to be confined at Coffee Creek, the women's prison in Wilsonville.
And that's where they're putting all the people that test positive. They put him there for 2 weeks and then brought him back to OSCI because I guess 2 weeks cures you of COVID.
So why wasn't he just released from prison?
My friend has been in almost 40 years. He gets out in February 2021. He's got everything he needs to be a productive citizen out here in the community. But because he fell at a young age on a violent crime, he is not eligible to be released early from prison. OSCI had no COVID at all until the wildfires. The smoke was getting really bad, burning towards where some of the prisons are down there in Salem, that forced the Department of Corrections to evacuate 3 prisons in Salem. They put them all in the Oregon State Penitentiary, where there was an outbreak, a known outbreak. I don't accept, well, we just made a mistake. We didn't have any plans to evacuate. You put 3 other prisons inside a known contaminated prison.
As of November 16th, the Department of Corrections website shows that there are no current adult in custody active cases of COVID at the Oregon State Penitentiary.
DOC has already admitted that they made a mistake and put these people at the Oregon State Penitentiary with the outbreak. You can't just stop an outbreak that quick and convince me that there's no outbreak there.
So according to the Department of Corrections website, they say they are following CDC guidelines concerning COVID-19, including sanitizing, wearing masks, social distancing. Ray, what are you hearing from your friends inside?
What I'm hearing from my friends is that the staff do not wear masks the majority of the time. The cleaning solutions that they give are watered down really bad. I know when I was serving my time that they watered down the chemicals. Also, they don't do anything for social distancing. They have the same people serving chow that are sick, living in sick units, cooking the meals for the guys in custody. And the word I'm getting is the officers at Oregon State Correctional Institution are doing what they want to do at officers' discretion. They're throwing that out a lot. It's officers' discretion. So it's officers' discretion to infect a whole bunch of people that don't need to be infected.
So one of the ways that the prisoners would be getting infected with COVID-19 would be the staff, correctional officers, leaving the prison, going home to their families and their communities, just going back and forth to work in the prison.
That's totally correct, because they have no visitors. They can't have anybody visiting. So people are disconnected from their loved ones out here, except for by a phone call.
And what about attorneys? Are attorneys allowed to meet with their clients inside the prisons?
Last I heard, they're only able to talk to their attorneys via a phone call.
And what is communicating like with prisoners and their families and friends?
I think it's 4 tablets for a housing unit that might have up to 100 people in it. I can't do video visits with my friends because there's not enough tablets to go around. Well, why not put them on a sign-out basis? You can have it for 4 hours, then you got to turn it in. You can't just check it out and keep it just because the officers want to be lazy.
Now, there are lawsuits against the Oregon Department of Corrections due to COVID-19 in the prisons. Are your friends inside the prisons involved in any lawsuits against the Department of Corrections?
The problem with that is they cannot tell me because phone calls are recorded and they'll be jeopardizing themselves to be giving out that information over a phone. Unless you're talking to your attorney, your phone calls are being monitored. So they're real careful of what they say to me, and they can't even put it in the mail because DOC has the right to open your mail even before they mail it out. They'll cut it open, then tape it shut. So getting communication is really difficult.
So, Ray, you say that the prison staff and officers are using their own discretion concerning wearing masks, social distancing. What about the prisoners themselves? Are they following CDC guidelines?
Only the prisoners that are in honor housing.
And what is honor housing?
Honor housing is where you live when you've stayed out of trouble for an extended period of time. You're working full-time, going to school full-time. You're being productive people in our prison system. So you earn the privilege of moving into what I call the Hilton of housing units, where you got more activities, you got more leeways. But right now what I'm hearing is the only unit that's pretty much on lockdown is the honor housing, because they know they can do anything they want with them guys, because them guys are trying to stay out of trouble, trying to keep their good jobs and stay in a housing unit where they get these extra benefits while they're serving their time. The people in the other housing units, they don't have nothing to lose, so they don't want to wear their masks. The officers ain't going to enforce it.
What about prison staff who test positive for COVID-19?
Well, I've heard that at OSCI, staff that have tested, knowingly tested positive for the coronavirus, are still coming to work and not wearing masks. The DOC, Department of Corrections, is their own entity. They're their own world. They got their own rules. But at the same time, they're a government agency and they need to follow the stipulations put out by our governor, because our small businesses out here, they're following the guidelines set out by our governor. Well, if they have to follow the guidelines, why shouldn't the DOC be held accountable to follow them same guidelines?
Do the prisoners have any recourse? Have any of them filed complaints or grievances?
Yes, and when they do, they get punished. They get punished. If they're in honor housing, they get kicked out of honor housing because they all of a sudden start getting DRs. All the inmates that want to file grievances, file lawsuits, if they're in honor housing, they get kicked out of honor housing. They lose their jobs. They lose their incentives. They don't want to lose anything, so they have to be really, really careful. There's another thing I want to throw out there is I'm getting ready to start a CURE support group where I can communicate with people's loved ones out here and help them understand what's going on the inside.
Ray, explain what CURE is.
CURE is an acronym, Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errands. Errands being the people in our prison system. And what CURE does is bridge the gap of communication between people out here and their loved ones on the inside. We help them understand how to get visiting, how to get money to them, everything they need to know about transition because their loved ones just went to jail. We help them understand all the particulars, how to get phone calls set up, how to get letters going in, addresses, all the information they need, we provide. And I'm getting ready to start one of them groups right here in Northeast Portland.
So how would friends and family of Oregon prisoners get in touch with you?
My email address is rayallenfox@gmail. rayallenfox@gmail.com. My phone number is 503-421-0269. So please text first, and then you're more than welcome to call.
As of November 16th, Oregon Department of Corrections is reporting 16 deaths of adults in custody due to COVID-19. Any comments?
I don't have any information on how many deaths, but with the massive amount of people infected with this, they're having outbreaks at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution, Snake River Correctional Institution, Oregon State Correctional Institution, Oregon State Penitentiary, and I haven't been in contact with people at the minimum facilities, but if they're having that big outbreaks, I find it really hard to accept that there's only been 16 deaths.
Ray, you've been out of prison now for 5 years. Why are you still connected with what is happening in the Oregon prison system?
The system needs overhauled. There's a lot more that could be done to help people better themselves while they're in there. So when they transition back out, how can we make that transition better for people getting out? How can we support that to stop the recidivism? After 30 years of incarceration at Columbia River Correctional Institution, they told me I did too much time, that I wasn't eligible for the transition programs. Anybody that's serving time needs the transition programs, especially the people that do a lot of time.
And Ray, give that information again about the new CURE support group in Northeast Portland.
My email address is rayallenfox@gmail.com. My phone number is 503-421-0269.
I've been speaking with Ray Fox. For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenny Yokoyama, and I'm also one of your interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KBOO, stuff about inside KBOO, what's going on outside of KBOO, but about KBOO. Basically,